Gigi, there was so much, there always is something so much inspirational when I hear you talk, but let's just start with education. There's a big debate going on about education. I've now been reading about these chaps from history who had no education and made incredible businesses and did incredible things. These cassipreneurs, generally speaking, how did they get to learn about becoming entrepreneurs?
Hello, yeah. So there's probably two primary ways they start. The one is we've seen this over and over. They had a mother or a gorgor or someone who was in business, or they were baking fet cook, and they would go out in the street, and so they've learnt it from their parents. And it's fascinating that, talk to education, is that the parents in this are often, big rider into this. And I did a talk a while ago to a Sunday Times business awards, and I had this room full of black and white, but particularly black business people. And I turned to them and I said at the end of my talk, I said, how many of you in this room were brought up or are here because of a gorgor who went and sold fet cook or sold little trinkets on the street corner to put you through school? Your mother or your gorgor worked like that as a hawker, and today you sit here and you have forgotten them. And half the room kind of nodded, because that is true. Most of them have been brought here from that. So we have, that's the one side. The other side is that an interesting amount of them come out of business. One of the guys I know was a pick and pay a manager, and then he left that and he started on his own. And, Bali, I spoke about, she was a cleaner in Cedar Square, Woolworths, and decided to move out of that. And so there's a kind of combination. None of them have any form of formal education, and most of them have no tertiary education. But there's a huge amount of helping each other. So often the Gorda outlet, you're working there, then the owner of the Gorda outlet says, okay, well, why don't you start over there and I'll help you start, and you keep growing the business that way.
Helping each other, but not getting help from the formal financial sector. Now, I know you're involved at Altvest. You're on the board there with Stafford Marcy and, of course, Warren Wheatley. Are you guys able to help yet? Are you moving in there yet?
So I was a very reluctant director, but only because I also have no formal education. I didn't know what being a director meant. But the reason I was part of it, albeit reluctantly, is that Altvest, for those who don't know, is about really democratizing finance and looking at how to support independent smaller businesses, particularly women-led businesses. And there's not enough of that kind of support out there. And I think what Altvest is doing is extraordinary. And it's, again, this is another example. How do we get involved in transforming the sector? Well, let's invest in it. Or there are so many ways we can do it. But there's no form of what they call development finance in this space. We have more of it outside of South Africa. And that development finance is in essence business finance. And it's generally short term and relatively small, 25 to 100,000 rand, and repaid over 6 months and sometimes even less. We don't have that. And so these businesses have to generate their own money from family, from savings and stokvels and so on. And again, that's the tragedy. And we interviewed a young guy, Rafilwe, who's got a bakery in Soweto. And Rafilwe has been really struggling. He was selling 2,000 loaves of bread a day. Load shedding is killing him. He went to the NYDA, which is a government youth financing, went to CEDA, the Small Enterprise Development Agency. And at the end of it, he said straight, he said, Gigi, I'm not a cadre. And and so the money is given to someone who's probably starting a chicken breeding thing and has three chickens and just got the money using that as an, and this is real.
Yeah, it's a real thing. And it's quite interesting what Wayne was saying as well, the impact that you see down. Cater deployment brings you bad people in municipalities who are not prepared to help and so on, and it keeps on going. But
In some ways, and this sounds terrible, in some ways, I believe it has in some ways inspired people to be more and to do better and to be more resilient. People have survived load shedding by the most extraordinary means. And load shedding is the ultimate democratization of suffering. It's one of the reasons the ANC are really worried about it, because the impact on the informal and township economies is massive. And so people have found ways around it. And the townships now, apparently when the power goes off, all the kids say, "Oh, Baba Cyril, Baba Cyril." But the point is that many of these businesses are there and have survived. And a measure of business success is generally a business worldwide that a business been in place for more than 2 years outside of a black swan event like COVID. They've survived 2 years, you generally can go. And most of these businesses have been there for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and they've managed to move on. And most of them will tell you, do not expect help from the government. And so they've just carried on. And the refrain that I hear all the time is that we're on our own.
What do you do with Capitec? You had an honorable mention when Ferry Furie was here earlier.
So my day job, paying for my daughter's show jumping horses, is advising companies on these markets. Part of that was, you know, how big the market is and what are the opportunities for banking that sector. And there is no form of small business banking up until now. I do think that, and I might be wrong, Khiri, but I remember Khiri standing up and saying, "Gigi, just cuck, there's no way that market's so big." So I'm glad he's a convert.
It sounds like. And what about Sean Summers is sitting here? Do you do much with him, Pick and Pay?
No, but I've met Sean, and I've done work with Pick and Pay in the past with Gareth Ackerman and Sean's predecessor.
It's like the old Raymond Ackerman days might be back there. What a lovely story that Raymond Ackerman had given the lady
250 Rand. I thought it was a lovely, but I think the reason I told the story is just the little things we can do that are transformative. And often we go like, well, how much more can I help? And actually we can. And we're surrounded by that informal economy wherever we are. You know, someone selling fat cook on the street corner here. And what are the ways we can support? And I'm hoping Outvest can do a little bit more than 250 Rand. But we can make this difference. And we can also push for people like our municipalities and our governments and our political parties to say, what are we doing about this? Why are we not incorporating this? Worldwide, small businesses, home businesses are the future. Many businesses start in a garage, and we need to just enable them more.
The BizNews conference used to, as you well know, be in the Drakensberg, and we would drive in rural KZN. And the point you were making about the houses is very, very well made. You, as you drive along those roads, you see these incredible buildings that seem almost impossibly located. There was also a conversation about the Ngonyama Trust or chief-based land and how this needs to be privatized so that or title deeds, etc. What's your view on that whole very emotive topic, given that you're a Masinga boy?
Yeah. So I think that the housing market can completely liberate, particularly if we can do, in a sense, what I would say is unsecured home loans. You know, we'll lend someone 5,000 Rand as long as they show us a pay slip. But you can own that house that's worth 1.5 million Rand and prepare to, you know, provide a security to build extra, and we won't lend them that. I think that housing market, the opportunity to give bonds that you can then use in other ways and to extend and whatever, is massive. And I talk about the difference between ownership and title deed. We're trapped in this concept of a title deed, and it's a very, very complex to do this. I mean, the thing of like the Gorko died and she had the title deed. She didn't have a will. And she got 10 grandchildren now who are all grown up, and they all say, "I've got a claim to that house." It's very difficult to do that. So I think that there's kind of two opportunities. The one is around what happens in the rural areas, which is called PTO, which is permission to occupy, which is like a form of sectional title. You never own the land, but you get the rights to that property, and anything you build more than a meter above the ground is yours, and you have the right to sell on the PTO. It's not a 99-year lease, it's permanent. And I think that that's one of the maybe the first step to do that. If we gave people PTOs, including traders, we've got a trader in a street corner with a container on a street, and we gave them PTOs, they would invest more in that business because they would know the Metro Police aren't going to chase them away. And it would enable them to sell that business. Currently, because they have no rights to the land that you're building the business on, you generally can't sell it, or you sell it for, you're just selling the equipment. And that would liberate it. I think we have to look at a different model. I believe in title deeds, and that we should be doing it more. And all the RDP houses should be should come with a title deed. Many don't, and should come with site and service, where they give you a piece of land and you build on, should be have title deeds as well. But if it doesn't, let's at least start with the PTO, which is a similar thing in Mozambique. After the civil war, the Frelimo burnt all the title deeds down. There were no title deeds left, and they had to return to this kind of thing. Oh, you've got rights to this land. We will give you a PTO, and that enables you to invest in it, and enables a bank then to finance it, and so on. And I think there's a lot of trapped. I mean, that 1.5 million rand houses just in the homelands, and it is extraordinary. I mean, every time I go, I shock myself. And that's not even talking about townships. Townships are 10 levels above that in terms of the value and the scale of that formal housing. If we could liberate that, it would be substantial.
And the potential is just massive.
Also consider that 80-odd% of informal businesses are operating from a residential premises. So once you've liberated them in terms of the house, you're starting to create the opportunity for the business to trade more securely, and so on.
James Hunt is going to be with us a bit later. I know the two of you are brothers from very different mothers, but you certainly do think the same way, on entrepreneurship. He's a great champion of entrepreneurship. So are you. Are there areas that you could combine your efforts?
I don't know enough about what Clem does, so but I here's where I think. I mean, I think there need to be more voices out there about this kind of thing. And you know, I quote in one of my books, I called it, in oral societies, there's no written history. There's no written stories about these businesses. And I talk about excavating silence, is how do we tell the stories of these kind of people? And I wrote in my books, and deliberately telling the stories, the human stories, because, you know, in a digital world, humans are still analog. And we should be telling these stories, and they're true stories, and they're one of hundreds and thousands. And the more we would tell these stories, the better it is. And you know, optimism also comes from hearing about these people who can become role models in their communities and to people outside. And someone said earlier we should be, you know, talking to the media. The media is terrible. I mean, every time I see something, it's like battered consumers. I saw a headline a while ago, so it's just shocking. It just says, something about struggling consumers turn to alcohol and clothing. And the story was about ShopRite's alcohol business grew by 12% and Pick and Pay's by 17%. And they don't say, well, gee, there must be more money there, and should we find out how? They kind of said, well, these people have no money, but they're spending on Johnny Walker Black and Nikes. And it's absurd. I saw another headline which said, 15% of households live in informal dwellings. Now, the figure was wrong, but it's about 8% according to census, you say. But besides the point, surely the headline is 85% of people live in formal dwellings. Isn't that amazing that people have invested in their houses, they've built these houses? 85% of people live there. Not that you fly, you know, just because you fly over shacks when you land at Cape Town International doesn't mean the majority of people live like that. And when we tell the right side of it, we don't sit in misery and feel bad all the time. Of course, the 15% is not great, but they're not the majority. I mean, the stats you say figures are about 11% of households live on the breadline. That's 1.8 million households out of 18.5 million households. That's terrible. It's unacceptable, but it's not. It's 90% are not living on the breadline. And these are the things that are not only important to tell, but they give us optimism, a real optimism, because they're real, And most importantly, when we look at the society like that, we find it more investable for ourselves. We're not going like, oh, doom and gloom, and everyone's poor, and they're going to riot and burn our houses down. We see a different image, and we're more prepared to invest in it. And that's an important thing in my mind.
Time to take your questions. And while we're waiting for you to put your hand up, Factfulness was one of the books that you recommended there.
Yeah.
Why?
So Factfulness, an extraordinary book, because, and the subtitle to Factfulness is How the World is Getting Better and You Don't Realize It. And it changed the way I looked at statistics and numbers and stuff like that. And I would recommend everyone reads it. It's by this crazy Swedish statistician who's since died. But Barack Obama and Bill Gates said the most important book to read, I think, in 2020. And there are just three things I want to highlight, or four things. The first thing he talks about is when we look at statistics, we have to look at spread. So we have this crazy figure that's spoken about all the time by every journalist in the country. It drives me crazy. It's like we're the most unequal place on the planet. It's an absolute rubbish figure. Inequality is measured by we have people who are the richest in the world and people in the who are the poorest in the world. Those are two different spots on a continuum. But if you don't look at where is everyone sitting, are they all sitting in the middle or are they all sitting at the top or the bottom? So the first one he talks about, look at spread, because the reality, particularly in South Africa, a vast proportion of people are sitting in the middle classes. The minority is really, really poor, and the minority is really, really rich. And so actually we're not. The most unequal place, the most equal place on the planet is Chad. Everyone's poor. Or Switzerland, everyone's rich. You know, it's such an absurd measure, and it's not true. The other thing he talks about is three major biases that are so important. The first one is anecdotal bias. Our maid or an Uber driver tells us about a gogo who lives in a shack with her 10 kids who's living on the breadline. It's a terrible story. It's a 100% true story. But we take that story and we extrapolate it to assume it's representative of the majority. The second one is media bias, which says that we read the same story about the gogo in the shack. It's a 100% true story. Again, we extrapolate it to say it's representative of the majority, which it's not. And then the third one is historical bias, which assumes what was true yesterday or the day before is going to be true today and tomorrow. And we know that the world is changing incredibly fast. And I just plead with everyone to either read that book, but also when you hear the story, when you read Daily Maverick and you have the violins playing in the background and whatever, it's not, don't extrapolate it to say it's true of the majority. It may be true, but look at what it's actually saying.
It's one of many good books that you can pick up there, but that's really one to change your whole mindset, sir.
It was, Mavusa this morning talked about two countries, you know, formal and informal. From your perspective, where's the opportunity for connection points between, say, entrepreneurs in this room and the businesses that you're talking about? If we wanted to connect, how do we find that space?
It's a good question. Yeah, like an informal stock exchange.
Yeah, it's a good concept. Thank you. I might consider it. So first of all, actually, they are not two worlds, because they literally live side by side. Recently, I was one of the chairman of Unilever. I said to him, who's your biggest customer? He said, ShopRite. I said, no, they're your single biggest customer. Your biggest customer is 100,000 Spaza shops out there stocking Homer. And if you look at the informal sector and you look around you, it's all around you. It's in the streets of the town. It's in the suburbs. It's in inner cities, rural areas, townships, and so on. And the reality is that a large number of businesses are engaging it directly, often as customers and so on. Look at the figures that ShopRite is doing. It's impossible if everyone's unemployed. Capitec, Pepco, a number of businesses actively involved in that. My argument is that we need to look at them not as suppliers, but how can we create reciprocal business relationships, like the one I specifically mentioned, Supreme, where they're investing in a loyalty program. The more Supreme you buy, the more we'll invest in your business. And, you know, Ford's founder did exactly this. He paid his staff higher than normal because he said they should be the customers who should be driving these vehicles. So how do we create an environment? Now, they're hard to find, but they actually all around us when we start looking at that. And I can't answer for entrepreneurs because I think one of the mistakes we make is we assume, it drives me crazy. People say to me, I'm in the township or informal economies. They go, spaza shops. And it's like, not every informal business spaza shop. All those sectors are there. So if you're in the bakery sector or supplying ovens for bakeries, then there's a whole angle there. And if you're in the car business, you know, those 80,000 odd Gassi mechanics and panel beaters, there's a whole solution around that. And so, you know, within the sectors that we are, there are solutions and there are ways. And these guys are there. When you start looking at them, and as I said, they're not only in a township. You don't have to get in and drive to Khayelitsha. You'll find them in Bellville. You'll find them in the middle of Cape Town at the taxi rank they call Top Deck there, and so on and so forth. So, yes, and many of them are in the townships. And there are initiatives. I mentioned the goat one particularly, but there's many initiatives out there starting to try and work with these. There's in Cape Town, the clothing bank, who get clothes from out-of-season clothes from people like Fashini, and then have sellers who have little businesses reselling those clothes. I think we need to look out for them. If that is what we want to do, there is opportunities, and you're always welcome to talk to me.
In the Cape, there's this problem of funding and how to fund local government and how you collect money to fund local governments. Okay. Now you've got these entrepreneurs, which is fantastic. I'm not talking about the guys at the Barragrana taxi rank or the little guy. I'm talking about that lady. I think she had 7 rooms, and what did she turn over at? At some stage, that lady is very rich. She should pay for electricity. She should pay for local government. Okay, I understand her local people may be crooks and they may steal it all. That's fine. Best she keeps it. But if they're not crooks, at some stage, she's going to have to do a bit like everybody else and pay for local stuff. Well, how do you see that?
You assume she's not paying for electricity and so on. She's got pay-as-you-go meters in each one of the units. She's got Wi-Fi. And in fact, I can show you pictures of it. And, you know, I think the assumption is often that these people are all operating illegally. Informality and legality are not the same thing. And then I hear, and Dabi Singh puts 148,000 rand a month into her bank account from her rent. It goes in her bank account. She's not trying to evade tax or anything. You know, the lady in Barragwanath taxi rank is paying the city council 300 rand a month for her little space. Now she's got about a 2 square meter piece of space with no services on it. If you go to Melrose Arch and you rent out serviced offices, they'll cost you 350 rand a square meter. I've done this exercise. So actually, she's almost paying the same amount as someone in Melrose Arch for that. The same goes in Warwick Street, Triangle in Durban. All those traders pay 100 rand a square meter for their piece of trading space, and they pay it to the Durban City Council. And yes, of course, there's those who are not paying it, and there's those who only operating in cash. But people are not operating that environment to deliberately not pay tax, and they're not using cash because they're trying to evade cash. In fact, the International Finance Corporation, part of the World Bank, did some research with about 2,500 informal businesses in 2021. It's called MSME Voice. And in that report, 3% of traders said that they used cash because they didn't want to pay tax. And I could tell you more about that. But again, also, you know, if we didn't have that demand, what would a ShopRite or a Pep or even Capitec be doing in terms of turnover, which of course they're paying tax on, I hope. You know, so that demand, we mustn't underestimate that demand in two ways. One is, how does it create social stability? if we had one in two people unemployed and they were really poverty was at incredible levels, we'd have huge social instability in our country. So at what price are these people giving us social stability? And the second thing is that they're all paying VAT and not claiming VAT. So the most businesses claim their VAT back. So there's a 15% net benefit to the fiscus. And I can add some other things, which I won't now, but it's a far more, it's not such a simplistic exercise.
Correct.
How's it, Gigi? May I ask the same question that I asked at the BizNews 10th anniversary, but because there was a far smaller audience there. And it's this, given what you've said, and thank you, by the way, what is the true unemployment rate in South Africa? I think at the time you said in COVID it was only about 12%, and outside of COVID it was only 10%. Now we see these horrendous numbers. So has that needle moved? And that's my question. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Rory.
So, by my conservative figures, the informal economy is worth about 750 billion rand a year in turnover. So three quarters of a trillion rand. And within it, you have the backroom rental, as I mentioned. You also, what I didn't mention is the spazas, especially the foreign or illegal Somalis and Ethiopians and so on. They pay 25 billion rand a year in rental for their properties that they're using as a spaza shop. So rental brings in about 45 billion rand a year to South African households. Now, my argument is that you can't just look at unemployment as a simplistic thing. Do you have a job and do you have a payslip? In fact, I often say, you know, like if you go to any of the taxi ranks and you look around, you'll see these posters on the wall. And the one poster will say, find lost lover. And the other one will say, penis enlargement. And the other one will say, credit, blacklist not important, bring 3 months pay slips and 3 months bank statements. Because if you do not have a pay slip in this country, you don't exist. So we are measuring in terms of formal employment, pay slip employment. And so when we look at it, if we take in account informal employment, informal incomes, and we also take in non-work, so as in passive incomes like rental and backroom rental or spaza rental. Because, of course, if I'm sitting at home and I'm unemployed, but I'm earning 7,500 rand a month, which is the average three backrooms, 2,500 rand each. And someone says to me, do you have a job? I'm like, no, I don't have a job. But we don't ask the next question. Well, how are you surviving and living in this nice space? So if we take those into account and we take what I call gig incomes, which is someone who's doing laundry, so it's not full-time or babysitting and so on, real unemployment or lack of incomes is no higher than 15% of our population, and I'm probably inflating it.
Gigi, thanks so much for just seeing people and their economic contribution. And a lot of the services that you mentioned people providing are those that perhaps were underserved in those areas or, providing, services there. And what I'm interested in, as your kind of study and just your kind of fascination in this field has grown from the past to now, how has the digital possibilities kind of shifted the kind of, so you've shown us that there's this incredible potential for growth, and now we have sometimes obviously electricity defending kind of the digital aspect to that. What do you see with that combined is some of the potential going forward and what might be some of the key investments to make for us to see an even fuller realization of that?
So this society is digitizing incredibly fast. You mentioned Lesaka, Alec. Lesaka turns over about 2 billion rand a month across 70,000 little devices sitting on spaza shops, hair salons, taverns, and so on, where you can go and tap your card to pay for your groceries, or you can do what they call cashback, where you can withdraw money from the till. And Lesaka does 2 billion rand a month across 70,000 outlets. In 2021, they did 0 rands worth of card transactions. Today, they do 45% of that turnover as card. So almost 1 billion rand today, 3 years later, is now card transactions. So we're seeing this incredibly rapid move into card payments, which again puts a lie to the tax thing, tax evasion, because actually the reason people were using cash is they had no alternatives. Now you can tap your card at the spaza shop. It's quite extraordinary. I anticipate that cash will in the next 5 years end up being about 30% at max of our economy as card and other products like PayShop accelerate. On the other side, we see this massive growth of smartphones, as I mentioned. Kheri mentioned 12 million of his 22 million customers are using the app. The use of digital apps is massive. The other huge space, e-commerce is accelerating really fast in the townships, but it's on two platforms, Facebook Lite and WhatsApp. Almost every hair salon, every spaza shop, not spaza shop, sorry, every hair salon, every tavern, fast food outlets like Mbali have a Facebook Lite page. All these smartphones come preloaded with Facebook Lite, same as Facebook, just low data consumption, and WhatsApp. So what happens is that you can go onto Mbali's Facebook page, you click on the WhatsApp icon there, it WhatsApps her a pin location from where you are and your order of chicken dust, and she gets some fine running down the road. And 30% of her business, especially in the evenings, is on those platforms. And so WhatsApp's an extraordinary, extraordinary platform. And the reason why is that people understand the concept of groups, they enjoy it, but most importantly, you do not pay for data for a WhatsApp. You buy a bundle at the beginning of the month, 30 or 50 or 55 Rand, and that gives you unlimited, in essence, almost unlimited WhatsApping for the rest of the month. So when you run out of data, you're still able to WhatsApp. And so e-commerce in South Africa and Africa is accelerating really fast, but it's not going to be on apps. And it's not going to be on the internet, on a web page. It's going to be on Facebook and WhatsApp. And most of these smartphones, there's 20 million we sell a year, come preloaded with Facebook and WhatsApp, but have a very low memory. So it's almost impossible to add more than 3 to 4 apps on that. So where we've got 1 million apps, WhatsApp and Facebook will dominate. And the acceleration into that digital space is quite extraordinary. I tell a story about a gogo who belonged to a stokvel who was almost 90. And I said to her, gogo, how do you communicate with each other in the stokvel? She said, Danam, I use what? I was like, what's what? And she reached into her breast and she pulled out this little Chinese smartphone. And she said, this what? She opened WhatsApp. She said, you know, Danam, I used to say to the kids, Kijim and Fana, go speak to my spanban. Now I just go, what?